Michael Horn is the co-founder and executive director of education at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation. He's also the co-author of Disrupting Class, How Disruptive Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns. And he has written a recurring column in Forbes and has writing in The Washington Post, The Economist, Huffington Post, and in Education Week. It is my pleasure that he's joining me today. And today we'll be discussing the book Blended, Using Disruptive Innovation to Improve Schools. Michael, thank you for joining me. My first question to you is, can you just talk about the book a little bit, reminding us what blended learning is and what types of K-12 blended learning models are out there?
Yeah, sure thing, Brian, and thanks again for having me and doing this interview. And it really came out of, as a sequel in many ways, to Disrupting Class, which came out in 2008, which observed that online learning was growing very rapidly as what we would call a disruptive innovation in the education world in general. I think that's been relatively well known in higher education, but certainly it's happening in K-12 education as well. And then since Disrupting Class came out, that growth accelerated in some key ways, but really blending the online learning into brick-and-mortar schools themselves. So starting in 2010, my co-author Heather Staker and I, and with her taking the lead on some of this research, really started looking out in the field, talking to about 100, 150 different educators who were doing what people were calling blended learning, and to derive a definition, a common definition that everyone could agree to in the field. And what we came out with was really blended learning is the combination of online learning where students have some control over the time, place, path, or pace of learning. It has to take place in part at a brick-and-mortar school with teachers. And then thirdly, that the modalities along each student's learning path have to be connected somehow. In other words, what you do offline has to somehow connect to that online experience that you're having as well. They can't be two totally different things going on. Otherwise, there's no blend. So that's the definition of blended learning that we derived. And then really what we noticed was that actually blended learning looked incredibly different in different places, not just around the country, but even within districts or even within schools. And so we started to work on coming up with a taxonomy just to describe the different ways we were seeing it unfold, not to be judgmental about them and say one is good or one is bad, but just to give people, educators on the ground, really a shorthand language to say, yeah, I'm basically doing this type of model, and then it would mean something to someone so that they could sort of visualize what was going on. And so the four basic types of models, we see rotation models where students are rotating between different activities, one of which is online learning at fixed points in time. The most common of those is a station rotation within a classroom, very similar to a center-based learning model that's existed in elementary schools for decades now. A second type of model we see is what we call a flex model, where the online learning now is really the backbone of the student's experience, but they're moving flexibly through different activities, whether those are online or offline activities. A third one is what we call the a la carte model, but it's in essence, students are taking one, two, maybe three online courses where the teacher is actually online, him or herself. And then the last category is what we call the enriched virtual. And this really stemmed from a lot of the full-time virtual schools that a lot of people have seen coming up for a number of years. And basically, a lot of those schools found, you know, we need a brick-and-mortar school-based element of this to help students out a little bit more, give them a little more support. And so they started adding required school days, one, two, 3 days a week, perhaps, in these enriched virtual formats.
Okay. Now, in the book, there's a great deal of discussion about concepts related to innovation theory and how to use this theory to help guide the direction of blended learning in these different models. Can you just describe disruptive and sustaining innovations and talk about how they relate to the different models you just mentioned?
Yeah, sure thing. So at a high level, and outside of education for a moment, disruptive innovations refer to these innovations that come along every once in a while, not that frequently, but every once in a while, that as judged by the traditional metrics of performance, actually don't look all that great, but they enable a whole new group of people to have access to a service that previously only people with expertise or wealth had. And because this new innovation education is simpler, it's more convenient, it's more affordable, accessible, decentralized, something around those sorts of dimensions. And over time, the disruptive innovation improves predictably, driven by the improvement of technology, such that over time, people migrate out to this disruptive innovation, and it comes to replace the dominant way we've always done things. Now, sustaining innovation plays a really important part in this world, which is that for the existing paradigm, if you will, existing classrooms in this case, sustaining innovations are basically the year-to-year or even day-to-day improvements that those entities are making to do what they already do, but do it better. And so when we looked at education more specifically, and let me say this clearly, because I think a lot of people read Disrupting Class and took away from it, oh, disruptive innovation equals good, sustaining innovation right. equals bad, yeah. therefore everything we do we'll call disruptive. And I just think that's a big unfortunate byproduct of that. I hope we didn't mislead people to thinking that, because sustaining innovations are absolutely critical. But the way it manifests itself in education is what we see is traditional classrooms are adopting online learning as a sustaining innovation, what we call a hybrid, the best of both worlds, to become better. And they still have seat time, do more with less in some cases, and things like that. And then we see this whole range of disruptive models, like the flex, enriched virtual, a la carte, and they basically do away with the traditional classroom altogether and start with the online learning, and then they seem to be snapping in brick-and-mortar components to help them improve over time. And our observation was just simply in the book that since disruptive models over time come to replace the existing models, mm-hmm. that over time we'd probably expect in high schools in particular, maybe middle schools, that the disruptive models of blended learning will come to replace the traditional classrooms that we have today. We don't know what time horizon that'll occur over, but that's the theory allows us to predict that over the next several decades, that's probably the trajectory we're on.
One thing that caught my eye is you kind of look at sustaining innovation and you think, oh, hybrid, blended, in place, and online, this must be a sustaining. And then you talk about how, there's models out there that are disruptive. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit and talk about which ones may be disruptive and which ones may be sustaining?
Yeah, it's an insightful question. So, and let me just affirm your original instinct also, which is that I think one of the big things that we sort of discovered in the writing of this book and our research over the last couple of years was that really, and we sort of knew it when we wrote Disrupting Class, but maybe not as explicitly as we should have, when we're talking about disruptive innovation in K-12 education, we're not talking about the disruption of schools. Schools, districts, those entities will still be here many decades from now, the theory would predict at the moment. And basically, all the blended learning that we're talking about occurring is a sustaining innovation or a hybrid to schools. But the big observation was that the disruption is happening at the classroom level within schools. So in those realms, you certainly see some hybrids where that traditional classroom is grabbing onto online learning to do better. And those hybrid models are the station rotation, like I mentioned, it keeps that classroom, but adds a center. The lab rotation keeps that classroom, students rotate out to an online activity. And then the flipped classroom, which actually has the word classroom in it, which helps us identify it as a hybrid model. But then those disruptive models to the traditional classroom are really that individual rotation, the flex, a la carte, and enriched virtual. And those often, they might be like three or four classrooms, knock down the walls between them and combine them into this big open learning space. Sometimes they much more resemble storefronts at shopping malls, and they look like workplaces that you might see in the modern office. So they don't really look like a classroom. And so basically the student experience is almost mediated, if you will, from the online platform, with a teacher, of course, but sort of the experience starts there, and then to get better, to better serve students, the online learning is basically saying, oh, we need actually to bring in brick-and-mortar elements. And we have this example in the book where some of your of people out there may be familiar with the retailer Bonobos, which is a men's clothing apparel retailer. Mm-hmm. And Bonobos, they started as online retailer, and they said, we'll never have brick-and-mortar stores. And then about, I think about 6 years into their existence, all of a sudden you started seeing bonobo showrooms start to pop up around cities in the country. And you said, whoa, what are they doing? Well, it turns out, I've gone to a couple of these now, they don't have any inventory in these stores. They're not classic stores as you'd understand them. They're just places where you can try on the clothes, get your size figured out, look at different colors in person, and then you still buy it online. And I think the emergence of the disruptive models of blended learning looks a lot like that. You have these online learning that had been coming up, you know, at least as far back as the Florida Virtual School in 1997, but they're starting to snap in brick-and-mortar components that look fundamentally different from a traditional classroom to be able to serve students who, quite frankly, need other students around them or adult peers, teachers, a safe place to learn, all of those supports that schools are really good at providing and for which, quite frankly, there's only a few students who can learn at home full-time in our society. Mm-hmm. That's not a sort of mass reality for most students.
Right, right. You know, in the beginning of the book where sailing companies wrote off steamships at first and then they were disrupted and then they were gone. How do we know that blended learning is the steamship, if you will, and not something like the smart board or the mini disc player, you know, fall flat in the market? What evidence do we have for that?
Yeah, I think we should say, again, right, with humility, right, we don't know for sure. I think what the theory suggests is that what's different about online learning here is a few fold. One, it really is following this pattern of disruptive innovation. Much of the steamship started in these areas of what we call non-consumption, where the alternative was really nothing because it was so primitive at first. And then it's been getting better and better and better over time and growing accordingly as it improves. And that's fundamentally different from a lot of these things. The second thing is that it's not just about the technology when you see disruption. It's really about putting a model around it that is coherent and can improve itself. And so in many ways, a smart board is a thing, right? It's not an instructional model for as far as school goes. Whereas online or blended learning is really, it's not just about the technology, because you can use mobile, you can use computers, there's lots of things you can use, but it's really about the model itself around this core technology. And so that's fundamentally different. And then the third thing I think is, what's different, I'd say, from this compared to, say, TV broadcast learning or radio right. broadcast learning in the past, or even CD-ROMs, quite frankly, is the interactive nature of it, right? Okay. The ability both to interact with teachers and students around the world, but also for the computer program itself to learn and get better over time because data is being exchanged in both ways. And so while I would be the first to tell you that the software out there in the market is not doing this enough yet, the opportunity to learn from what is and isn't working on the ground and improve accordingly based on that feedback is quite tremendous in this realm.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you point out in the book, some of the software that does it the best, like Khan Academy, is the cheapest, so that's something that I find
yeah.
interesting and it useful and hopeful, too, if this is something we really want. You know, I know you mentioned that schools, they want the best. In the beginning, sometimes they had to pay a lot of money to get some of these great features, and then you go on to say, you know, Khan Academy is one of the better ones, and it's free. So, yeah. I found that.
You couldn't have pointed to Khan Academy 5 years ago and thought it was around, but you couldn't have pointed to it and said, gee, that's going to change the face of the world. Look at how much better it is, and I think with the analytics and data and assessments that they're building, not to say that they will be, you know, a winning solution per se,
right.
but I think they have a good chance. They're emblematic, I think, of what else is coming on down the pipeline.
So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about kind of what you see as the benefits of these programs. In the book, you mentioned blended learning enables personalization. It increases access to courses, and it helps control costs. Can you kind of expand on that and talk about how blended learning accomplishes these goals?
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say up front, my impression is that's the driving reason for the adoption in the field.
Uh-huh.
Just because someone has adopted blended learning doesn't mean it's good and doesn't mean it's accomplishing all three or maybe even any. But the personal personalization, by the nature of the software that we're starting to see, it allows each individual to have much more control over their, certainly their time of learning. They can log on at night, they can watch a lecture, play a game, do a simulation, work on their project. They can go much more control over their pace of learning, right? They can speed up, slow down. If they don't understand something, repeat something, whereas they aren't tethered to the classroom pace that they traditionally were. They have much more control over the pathway of their learning as well. And we're starting to see the rise of playlists in online learning, where students have 10 different ways to learn a particular topic, or maybe they won't follow the course sequentially, right? For them, it makes sense to go a different way through the material. So we're starting to see a lot more personalization around those dimensions. And those are some of the things that blended learning very inherently starts to enable. In terms of the access and equity, I think you said it yourself, right? There's lots, millions, quite frankly, of students in schools across America that don't have access to particular courses they may need or want for their futures. And now you can deliver an online experience and access to a high-quality teacher almost regardless of where someone lives, particularly as the infrastructure and broadband connectivity gets better and better. And then in terms of the cost control, the way I've been thinking about it is people love to ask, is blended learning cheaper than traditional? And I think the answer is, with many things in life, is, well, it depends. If you put eight students in a room with a teacher and computers, it's probably going to be a heck of a lot more expensive. If you put 30 students, it might be cheaper. It sort of depends on how you implement it. But what we are seeing is that blended learning is enabling these benefits of personalization and access and equity to be extended at a cost that doesn't break the bank. In other words, in the past, for example, if you wanted to do personalization, you really needed almost a tutor for every single child, and that just happens to be really, really expensive,
right,
and
yeah,
prohibitively so. Now you can start to do these things, right? And that's sort of how I think about the cost control element. I guess the second part of it is that you saw a lot of budget cuts and tight budgets, particularly mm-hmm. in places like California over the last several years. And I don't think it's any coincidence that basically every single charter school there has moved toward blended learning out of tighter budgets where they might have to have slightly higher class sizes and things of that nature.
Now, do you have any examples that you can point to that you see as kind of best practices for accomplishing some of these goals? You talked about, you know, some poor implementation may not accomplish these goals. You give a lot of great examples in the book. Can you give the audience, you know, maybe an example or two about good ways that schools are accomplishing these goals?
Certainly. So I think for, and I'll probably end up, if we do examples, repeating some of these, but for personalization, Summit Public Schools, it's a charter school network in California, they've done a really good job of creating playlists for students whereby there's roughly 10 different ways to learn each concept. Students have a high degree of ability to personalize learning for their particular needs, and a large degree of control over that time element as well. They devote 16 hours a week to personalized learning time for students, where they can really log on and follow their own pathway, and then every Friday students are meeting with mentors who are teachers assigned to them as mentors to really chart out their individual learning goals for that week ahead, figure out what they want to master, how they're going to do it, how they're going to allocate time, and so forth. So that's a pretty exciting, I think, example of the personalization track. On the access and equity, you're seeing a lot of interesting ones pop up, particularly in rural schools, and in the book we talk about in Alabama, how they set up what's called Access, an online learning, virtual learning school to offer courses to students, particularly in rural Alabama, that just didn't have access to AP courses and things of that nature. And they started to see AP test numbers pick up, both in terms of access as well as scores themselves, because many, many more students had access to these experiences than before when they lived in these schools where they didn't have the bandwidth or access to teachers to be able to offer these sorts of experiences. And then in terms of the cost control, idea that small group instruction would be key to their academic success. And literally right before they opened, a few months beforehand, they got the news that based on budget cuts within the state, they would not be able to have one of the teachers that they had counted on. And so therefore they were going to have higher class sizes, roughly 30-to-1 class sizes. And so they basically realized that if they could implement a station rotation model, 10 students at a time could be working on computers, 10 students on groups doing collaborative projects, and then 10 students basically on the rug in small group instruction with the teachers, so that they could preserve that small group part of their instructional model, which was so important to them, but do so in the confines of greatly reduced revenue.
One critique that I've heard about blended learning or online learning in particular is that people say that they might not be suitable for certain academic subjects. Can you talk about how a blended school can design a program where they still have, you know, subjects like art and music and things that might not be suitable to be learning on a computer screen?
Yeah, absolutely. And glad you asked this, because you do hear that a lot. And it ranges from some people saying, well, it's great for math, but not for social studies, right? Mm-hmm. And then it goes to, oh, I see how it can work on social studies because, you know, the teacher can facilitate really interesting conversations and you can do all sorts of simulations and explorations of what it was like to live in the past, and you see Florida Virtual School's conspiracy code for American history and things like that, and you start to stretch your mind about what this could look like. And then people say, well, but, you know, music, arts, it won't work for that. And so I think there's two responses. One is, one of the things I think blended learning will do is allow us to almost commoditize the delivery of core academic instruction to allow schools to free up resources to actually pay attention to those things you can really only do in a place-based way, which may be around sports or arts or certain orchestral activities, things like that, right? And so if it frees up resources to continue to devote those things, I think that's a great thing, because over the last 10, 15 years, we've seen way too many schools cut those sorts of programs that are critical for developing students into great citizens and people. The second thing, though, is I think actually blended learning can help with those things. And one of the things we're seeing is Holton Arms, for example, in Washington, D.C., actually uses blended learning for its music instruction. And what they found is that there's software out there that is far more patient with a student than any teacher at helping them practice their music and identifying wrong notes or when they're maybe out of rhythm or the pitch is just slightly off if you're playing a wind instrument, for example, and can immediately give you feedback, not just once a week when you have a lesson or not just when the conductor in your orchestra class happened to hear you. And I can tell you as someone who's conducted orchestras, if there's 50 people out there, you may or may not get to every single one in the course of a week or let alone a month. These sorts of things can actually give you the core instruction to accelerate, and then you can go in with your fellow peers and have maybe the more group experience of putting something together, right, in a band or orchestra type setting. And of course, we're seeing with Skype orchestras and YouTube orchestra and things like that, that actually you can do these virtually as well, which is really interesting if you live in a community where maybe there's not enough people to field a full orchestra. I know less about art, but obviously lots of art is now done on a computer, so I suspect that there's similar things being done and the ability to bring in high-quality instructors, and not just instructors, but quite frankly experts from the working world of art to give, you know, real-time student feedback on your projects or helping you understand, gee, if you're really good at this, these are careers that might be open to you. A lot of creativity, I think, can go into designing these experiences with online learning technology.
Let's talk a little bit more about the students. There's an extended section in your book about student motivation, or at least there's a chapter or two. Can you talk about how you see blended learning as being a motivating factor for students and the role blended learning has in motivating students to come to school and engage?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we have a different perspective from a lot of researchers who've studied motivation, which is to say that a lot of people will say, well, some students are motivated and others are unmotivated. And indeed, if you talk to parents or teachers, you'll hear the same sort of language. Our sense is that all students are motivated, but they're not necessarily motivated by school. They're they're motivated to feel successful and make progress in their lives. They're motivated by things like having fun with friends. And so the question is understanding what motivates them. How do we create school to get their jobs done, in effect, but also get society's jobs done for school as well around, you know, instilling core knowledge, skills, and dispositions, and so forth? Our sense is that blended learning actually opens up lots more opportunities for this, particularly, well, on the two I mentioned, both being successful and making progress every day, as well as the opportunity to have fun with friends. And so briefly, one of the key findings is that our current schools are actually terrible at the success job because the opportunities to show that you were successful only occur every few weeks when there's a test that arises. And when the test comes up, it's actually often designed in a way to make most students feel like failures because it's graded on a curve such that, by definition, a lot of students will not pass or will get less than satisfactory grades. But then they move on to the next unit, right, regardless of how they did, and may fall further and further behind and so forth. The thing about blended learning is it can start to bring in what I would call competency-based learning, where students move on upon mastery of a given subject or skill, and therefore you're constantly delivering learning just above the student's current level, not too high that they get frustrated and feel failure, not too low that it's so easy that they have no sense of meaning. And then the second part on the having fun with friends is it can free up a whole lot of time for much more positive peer interactions, because it can allow teachers to start to facilitate Socratic group discussions, logic-based learning, things of that nature that have previously been difficult for teachers to do in a meaningful way because they've sort of been pulled between delivering a lesson plan and giving core instruction in accordance with the calendar and the curriculum required, but also knowing that these other things are equally important to be able to deliver for students across Bloom's taxonomy, if you will. So I think blended learning starts to break these trade-offs in many ways. I'll tell you one other thing that was surprising to me when I've gone to blended learning schools, which was I was worried in many ways that I would just see lots of students clicking mindlessly away on computers and not having much interaction and sort of being an uninspiring environment. And the good ones that I've gone into, that's actually not what's happening. Sure, they might be spending time on computers working through it, but then you start to see students all of a sudden pop up from their desks and walk over to either their friend or just someone, you know, one of their peers next to them or across the room and start to say, oh yeah, I struggled with that last week and the way I figured it out was, and they start teaching each other. And so my memory of what, say, middle school was like was that a lot of our peer interactions were to get around the teacher and to avoid academics, right? To pass mm-hmm. notes in class, to break pencils, things of that nature. All of a sudden you have an environment that by changing sort of the purpose, right? We're all trying to get ahead in our learning wherever we are, and we know that sometimes you'll move faster than I will, and sometimes I'll move faster than you will. It all of a sudden creates a much more positive experience where people are bouncing off each other to help each other around the academics, and it sort of created a team-like game environment where everyone's trying to get in on the fun together, and that's a very different experience from a traditional classroom.
Now, you know, a lot of education research now is dedicated to urban school districts and places where students live in extreme circumstances and have difficulty learning because of a lot of barriers from their home life. How do you see blended learning as helpful or useful for those types of students who need even more resources and human interaction and things like that?
Yeah, so I think two things. One, again, a lot of those students come in with huge skill and knowledge deficits right from the beginning, that whether it's the number of words that they've heard and therefore their aptitude for picking up language and math and things of that nature. And blended learning is great because it can tailor to their actual level, so it can build in those core knowledge and skills to give them the foundation to start to progressing to more and more challenging and advanced concepts without building in them that failure of I'm not good enough for math or something like that. And I think that's something we often miss is we say, well, the curriculum says it's, you know, September 30th, and therefore we ought to be doing this concept because we have to deliver it. But the reality is if a student doesn't have the foundation for that experience, there's very low likelihood that they'll understand or master or be successful, and it'll just push them further and further behind. So I think that's one. The second thing is these students also, as you noted, come in with a whole range of health challenges often, or family structure issues, or counseling needs, things like that. And my sense, again, is if blended learning can commoditize some of the pure just content and instruction delivery, it can free up both resources and teacher time and allow for team teaching environments, even maybe, where there's a whole team of people there designed to support students along all these non-academic reasons that they may struggle, and spend much more time and energy on those things that really need to be done locally and in a much higher touch way. And if you talk to teachers in blended learning environments, that's what they typically say, is they get to know their students far, far better, and they have far more time to work with them one-on-one or in small groups. And so you're basically freeing up that time to work on all of those things that are so challenging for some of these students in these urban environments. And so that's how I think, maybe not a direct way, but I think by freeing up resources and time, it's actually quite powerful what it could do.
Let's talk about the teacher a little bit. You mentioned their shifting role in the book. Can you describe what you see the role of a teacher is, or a good teacher in a blended setting, what that looks like?
Yeah, so this was actually one of our favorite chapters in the book. Heather really, really got excited about this chapter because there's sort of this nasty refrain, if you will, when technology comes up in education, where people say, oh, you just want technology for teachers. And I think people who are serious about this work don't think that way, right? They know that teachers are absolutely critical to student success, and that really this is a tool that can help them. What I think we're seeing is that it does change the role of teachers, however. They don't have to deliver lesson plans to an entire class. They may not have to do any lecturing or it depends, right? And it can allow them to spend a lot more time on mentorship, facilitation of discussions, project-based learning, evaluating student work, particularly the more complex things for which computers are not particularly well-suited at this point in time, and things of that nature. And so, to answer your question, I think it's difficult to say this is, you know, the way that teachers will look in the future. What we're seeing is, depending on the type of model that you put into place and a bunch of the design decisions that you make along that road, you will have different job descriptions for your teachers. And I think that's one of the real challenging things right now, is that despite efforts to sort of codify the competencies that teachers need to be successful in these environments, the reality is a teacher who's teaching in a lab rotation in Milpitas School District in California is very different from the skill set needed by a teacher teaching in Quakertown Public Schools in Pennsylvania right now in a blended learning environment, because they're just doing very different things. But I think some of the opportunities are for team teaching, specialization in the areas that you really like as a teacher or are really strong in. One concrete example of that is data is going to be much, much more important and much easier to access, hopefully, in the future with blended learning. Right, with the amount of information we'll understand about how students are doing with the frequent assessments online. Some teachers, I'm quite certain, are not going to be excited about digging into the data to figure out what should I do for a given student, whereas other teachers, I think, are going to be thrilled to just geek out on the data and dive deep and figure out how do I construct an individualized learning plan for this child. But they might not be so excited about actually working alongside that child as the individualized learning plan is given through certain activities. And so fortunately there will be another teacher who didn't like the data but is really excited about the small group or individual tutoring work. So I think these are some of the ways we can imagine the role changing, but I still think it's very early and different places will likely do different things. But hopefully this gives people out there a sense of just the plurality of roles and creativity that I think we'll see in the future for the role of the teacher.
In your experience with different blended learning schools, I'm sure you've had a chance to talk to teachers. What are some of the things that they've said? Have you seen some kind of pushback or resistance, or have you seen a very receptive group of people, you know, towards these new programs? Do they see it as helpful for their job, or what kind of things have you talked to teachers about on the ground?
Yeah. Gosh, that's a good question. So I think you hear a few things when teachers move into blended environments. One is that I know way more about my students. I'm able to reach each individually in ways I never could. I just can't imagine going back to before this. And so I'm more satisfied in many ways with my job. You also hear, however, my job is more difficult than it was before, because I could just deliver the lesson and I knew a certain percentage wouldn't get it right. But holy cow, now that I can see all this data and I can see how different students are doing and how much more I could be doing, oh my gosh, there's like limitless work. And so it's actually really hard, right? And then the third thing that I hear a lot is my preparation and professional development did not prepare me for this new job. Like 5% of what I learned in my teacher education program is for maybe 95% of what I now do, and 95% of what I learned is sort of irrelevant, is maybe for 5% of what I now do, mm-hmm. right? And so you can question teacher education more generally, I think, around the country, but blended learning really changes the game, and I think teachers feel a justifiable sense of frustration around that, and it puts pressure, I think, on schools of education to catch up, if you will. And the but I think those are the three most common refrains I hear. So it's positive, but it's tough. And how do we prepare? Actually, let me say one other thing.
Okay.
Which is 6 months in, often, so teachers will really struggle for those 6 months and talk about how they don't have the PD and mm-hmm. preparation and so forth for it. Teachers are smarter than society often gives them credit for, and almost invariably they start to figure it out, right? So they start to say, gee, I don't need to do this, I need to do more of that. And so I would say, well, as a education sector, we're not filling in those gaps adequately yet. Teachers are figuring it out and hacking their way to making it work better and better and getting smarter and smarter about what they do over time. So one of the things I think we can do as a community, sort of in the broad sense of that word, is give teachers more and more opportunities to talk with other teachers at other schools who are doing blended learning and just trade secrets of the trade, if you will, while we sort of figure out the best way to actually construct education programs for these new roles.
Okay, so we have just a few minutes left, so maybe we should shift a little bit to talk about implementation. So how do you kind of recommend that for a school, their implementation strategy so that teachers do have the time and the implementation does go smoothly?
Yeah. Well, it's a critical thing because I think we have seen where smart boards or other devices have been foisted upon teachers and just created more time without sort of giving them the better teaching that they desired, right, for their students. So our recommendation in the book is not a best practices way of just adopting blended learning or something like that. It's more to say each place is going to be different. What you need for your students is going to be different. So here's a design guide to walking you through how do you set up a blended learning environment to match what you want it to be and do. And so the first part of that is to start with, why are you doing this? What's the rallying cry, your reason for looking for this innovation? And so we ask you to think about, what problems are you trying to solve? Goals are you trying to achieve? And then really state how you would know that you've been successful by making that goal very concrete in numerical terms so that everyone in the building knows whether, 2 years from now you've been successful or not, but also to give you a way to calibrate yourself over time. The next step is to really build a team, bring a team to the table to help you solve that problem and design a solution. And then we say basically start with the student experience, map out the ideal that you want, map out the ideal teacher experience you want, and then start putting the rubber to the road by figuring out the content, hardware, broadband infrastructure, classroom or school design to match those sorts of experiences, right? And then we hopefully in Chapter 8 of the book give a what's hopefully an easy checklist, say based on the decisions you've made here, this is probably the instructional model you're going to put into place, and we're making that free on blendedlearning.org as well, that part of the book. And then from there, really be intentional about the culture that you build as you start to implement that design, and do it in a humble way. Start small. We call it discovery-driven planning, but really be able to identify the big assumptions that you're making and iterate accordingly so that you don't go out with say $1 billion initiative from the get-go and then find out a couple months in that your assumptions were wildly off and you have sort of a spectacular failure that drives press headlines.
Okay, so those are pretty much all the questions that I had. Do you have any final thoughts or final words that you wanted to just add before we finish our conversation?
Well, I think the mark of a good interview is that there were good questions, and hopefully the answers just kept pace. So I think on that score, you certainly aced this one.
Oh,
so
thanks. I appreciate
the thoughtful questions. I think that's the most important thing, and I think even honestly, just to tie it back into the book and the topic, I think as people are going through the process of designing these environments, asking questions, being cynical, and then coming up with solutions out of those questions is a really critical part. And in many ways, the adoption of blended learning mirrors, I think, the lifelong learning process and appetite that we hope to instill in all of our students.
Great. All right. Well, thank you, Michael. Again, the book is Blended: Using Disruptive Innovation to Improve Schools. The interview was with Michael Horn, and the other author who could not make it today with us was Heather Staker. And yeah, I encourage everyone to check out the book. It's a really good read and captures some really important innovative ideas for the future of education. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you.